Hello, everybody. Mark Carlson here, SNEA Technical Council Chair. Welcome to the STC Podcast. Every week, the STC Podcast presents important technical topics to the developer community. Each episode is hand-selected by the SNEA Technical Council from the presentations at our annual Storage Developer Conference. The link to the slides is available in the show notes at snea.org/podcast. You are listening to STC Podcast Episode 16. Today we hear from Jeff Gentry, Regional Director with an Independent Security Evaluator, as he presents Hackers, Attack Anatomy, and Security Trends from the 2015 Storage Developer Conference.
So my name is Jeff Gentry. I work for Independent Security Evaluators. Our headquarters are actually in Baltimore, Maryland, but I have the luxury of living and working remotely in Austin, Texas. So what I want to do today is kind of have a bit of an analysis on hackers and how they operate, right? We've all heard from headline news, you know, about company XYZ was hacked, but what does that mean? You know, how did they do it? How did they execute that particular attack? Why did they go after those assets? And what we'll walk away with, hopefully, is a range of lessons that we as a community of technologists can use to improve. The goal is not to just talk about it, to actually figure out ways where we can become more resilient against modern attackers. You know, we can better secure assets. So why is this important? I always ask this question when I'm giving a talk in the simple talks that I give. The attackers are becoming much more sophisticated. Attack vectors, much more involved. Digital assets are much, much, much more valuable than they were. And the traditional defenses are no longer close enough. And everything that I talk about, these attacks and the takeaways, will support most of these points. But another question is, you know, why are you guys here? You know, some of you guys are from California, and he's from Colorado. You know, why do you take time out of your day to come and watch me get a talk? And believe it or not, I actually heard all of these excuses on the bus. Every single one. The funny one was running from the law. Guy had a warrant out, so he decided to go out of town until he came back, and so he was willing to deal with it. But yeah. Mileage runs, expense accounts, whatever it is. Hopefully you're here to learn something or meet someone. And I think there's a lot of valuable information in here. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about deals with mindset and perspective. Both the mindset of the malicious adversary, their perspective, their motives, how they attack, but also your mindset, you as developers and engineers, how you build things, how you go about the security process of actually securing them before you deploy them. It's all about mindset and perspective. And so a lot of that will kind of be woven in throughout this talk. And so I'm going to talk about a few companies, some quicker than others. I think the real value is in the lessons, not necessarily the attacks, but the attacks are all kind of interesting. Not everyone knows how these attacks actually occur, but we'll run through Texas Instruments and Target and the iPhone. We were the first company to break the iPhone. It's kind of our claim to fame, so we still talk about it. People still ask us about it. So as long as people still ask, we'll still talk about it. And that'll be the last one that I discuss. So the first is Texas Instruments. And ISE was founded in 2005 out of the Information Security Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Specifically, a lab designed to study RFID technology. And at the time, Texas Instruments had this DST-40 system that they touted as unbreakable. And whenever you tell a bunch of hacker-minded computer scientists that something is unbreakable, the response is always going to be challenge accepted. Every single time. And so what we did was we set out to design a study to break that technology. With the idea that if we're successful, there's going to be some commercial interest. And if there's some commercial interest, perhaps we should start a business. So on paper, in a lab, by a bunch of hackers, I asked this story.
And
the reason we felt compelled to talk about or to research this particular piece of technology, the DST-40 system, communication protocol that TDOT had out in Kentucky was because it was used in two very important systems at the time. The first being the foreign mobilizer key, and the second being the ExxonMobil speed pass. Now, for the foreign mobilizer key, I mean, you guys get how keys work. You put in the ignition, physical action, turns in the engine. And how it was used with Ford was there was an authentication between that particular key and the onboard computer of the car. Is this the right? And with the ExxonMobil speed pass, same thing. You attach your credit card to that particular token, put it on a keychain, and you had secure communication between that token and the gas pump and the register inside. You can only go inside and buy bunions, that wallet. So these were two very important systems at the time. And what happened was we ended up studying the technology for a few weeks, trying to figure out exactly how it was architected. And then we spent a few weeks reverse engineering the cryptographic algorithms to carry the test. And then a couple of weeks after that, there we were, proof of concept. I started a car, people got made of letters for a car. Super simple, unbreakable. And so after that, that's how ISE was born. There's a bunch of stuff about us that I'm not going to talk about because you guys don't care. So the first hack I want to talk about today is Target. And I know this happened, 18, 24 months ago at this point? But it's still really, really interesting because it harmonizes quite nicely with the principal message that we discuss internally. And that is all about supply chain security, vendor security. And it goes to this idea of, attacks, traditional attacks and traditional defensive methodologies no longer being deployed. So what happened with Target is one of their vendors, which in this case was an HVAC company, was the victim of a spear phishing campaign. And that spear phishing campaign granted credentials in Target's network environment to bad guys. And so once they got into the maintenance environment, which the reason this company had access to the maintenance environment was to perform certain operational functions, such as controlling the heating, things like that, making sure vegetables were cool enough at night, but you could say $17.50 per location for vegetables good, so certain operational functions were required. It's on the top of this one. So what happened was, due to improper network segmentation, the bad guys were able to jump from the maintenance environment to the payment environment. And as I'm sure most of you guys know, this is not a good thing. And so once they were able to navigate into the payment environment, they were able to deliver a malware payload known as a ransom. And what this ransom scraper did was basically search for 15 to 16 digit numbers, like in American Express, or what it's called. And then once it found one, it copied it to a file within Target's environment on one of their servers. And it did. And
I wish I had my clicker, because I got really cool pictures.
So once they were able to get these, copy these numbers and hide them, what became really neat and really sophisticated about the attack was the exfiltration method. Right? How do we get that data out of Target's environment and get it into our possession? And so what happened is there's a communication protocol called NetFIOS, which allows for systems to one another, talk to one another, and they were able to take advantage of that and exfiltrate that data inconspicuously among normal traffic. And so that data left Target's environment to compromise servers all over the world. And once it was completely out of Target's environment, they were then able to take possession of those servers. And once they did, for that data, I should say. And once they took possession of that data, they were interested.
So what's the key takeaway? What's the lesson? And the idea is,
again, goes to perspective and mindset. It's to secure assets and not perimeters. We still talk to companies every day, Fortune 500 companies, that are hell-bent on securing their perimeter.
right? It's what we want to do. Put a chain link fence up around it, barbed wire, whatever it is, you have to protect the perimeter. And unfortunately, that's an antiquated way of doing things. Traditional defense methodologies defend against traditional attacks. And traditional attacks, you know, come from, they're either people-focused, they're either both a digital or remote attack, or, you know, a physical attack on the infrastructure itself, right? Going in, stealing the server, whatever it is. Traditional defenses, of course, employ training for your employees. You see training all the time, and training is a good thing. Defensive products, firewalls, IPSs, those types of things. And we also see, of course, security guards. You see security guards probably outside the hotel's building here. You have them all over Austin downtown, security cameras, things like that. Those are all fairly decent options for traditional attacks. Unfortunately, modern attacks are completely different. Modern attacks use a growing number of attack vectors from embedded systems, integrated vendors, things like that. So, as illustrated in the Target example, you had an attack on Target where they used the vendor of Target to not only get access, to also deliver the malware payload. So it's really, really interesting how they did that. So how do you defend against it? Well, securing assets, not perimeters, by building layers of defensive depth. It's really easy. In theory, you want to lock down your most high-value assets first and work out the security. That's the name of the game. So whenever we go into, or any good security firm, we'll go into consulting engagement with the company, it's all about where are your assets? How valuable are they? Why are they valuable? Who wants to go after them? Let's build a threat model. And then let's lock down what it says. And you really want to operate under the premise that the bad guys are already there. We've already lost the war in regards to security. The bad guys are already there. So you have to operate under the assumption that you can no longer defend your perimeter, that you can defend your assets. And that's what we advocate on from lots of companies. It's not just about ISE. Sometimes through this talk, I'll talk about ISE, but it's really any good security firm. It's going to talk about assets and not perimeters. Second thing we're going to talk about, and this one is actually really, really interesting because I can't tell you who it is. It is a global chipset manufacturer that you guys use their product every day. And they came to us, it's a really interesting story, but they came to us and they needed us to take a look at their newest secure chipset. And what was told to us was, I want a black box penetration test. And our response is always when we hear that, but what is it that you really want? What are your goals? And the goals are always, well, I want to figure out how to be most resilient against an outside attack. How can I really protect the assets? And so our response is always, well, what you really want is a white box vulnerabilities. Your goals harmonize with a white box vulnerability assessment and not a penetration test. And it's kind of interesting because there's been a lot of ambiguity regarding these terms. And there's been a trend over the last couple of years, it's kind of becoming in vogue to get a black box penetration test. We see the requests all the time. And when we have those conversations, we always try to refocus the customer and try to really determine what his goals are. You know, if you just need to check boxes, then you can get a black box penetration test. You can have someone else do that. But if the idea is to actually become secure, and what you want is a black box vulnerability assessment, and companies like ours can help you with that. And so it boils down to access level and evaluation types. Has everyone in this room seen this? Are you familiar with these terms? Most of the people in here? Going on. Okay. So it basically boils down to access level and evaluation types. In a black box evaluation, the investigative entity has no inside knowledge of the product itself. All you can gather is what's publicly available, okay? And you go at it like a complete outsider. In a white box access, we have access to engineers, developers, C-suite guys, get access to source code, design documentation, everything that you could possibly want when you're assessing a product or a system. And then you have evaluation types. And a penetration test is pretty much binary in nature. Can I or can I not reach the defenses? And a vulnerability assessment is completely different. And it works to identify every single vulnerability and provide mitigation. That's the way. So in the white box vulnerability assessment, you have access to everybody in the organization, and you're looking for every possible vulnerability within that system. Then and only then can you actually make an execute. Has anybody heard the castle analogy as it relates to security and penetration tests? Alright, this will be fun. We talk about this a lot because it really illustrates the differences between black box and white box work. And security firms typically will migrate one way or another. Some security firms only do black box work. Some security firms only do white box work. We're one of those that only do white box work. That's really all we do. And so, this example is a team that wants to have a security audit done on this asset. He wants to know how secure his assets are, which are basically himself, right? So, he calls in his cousin from 13 years away, and has his cousin bring in all of his knights to perform the security audit. So cousin shows up and starts looking at the castle, and he says, well, I see that you've got a drawbridge, I see that you've got a moat, I see that you've got alligators in the moat, you've got archers in the turret, you've got guys on the top of the hot oil, you're secure, right? There's no way we can reach the castle. And so, later that night, he goes to bed, tells his personal guard to stand by his door, don't worry about me, I have this awesome security audit, I'm good to go. So the next morning, they find the king dead and his head's chopped off. Well, so how did that happen? Well, it turns out that if you look at it from a completely different perspective, you would find this egress point that no one knew about. So that egress point is a secret tunnel built from the castle of this building so that the king can escape in times of siege. Only he knows about. Someone else knows about that, right? Get up over. Probably find a way in. So the egress point can be repurposed as an egress point. So when we contrast that with what would happen if the king had ordered a white box vulnerability assessment? What would happen? Well, the king would have obviously probably still invited his cousin 15 years away at all of his nights. But he would have also had a meeting with the architects, the designers, the guys that actually built the castle, probably his own team. And he would also divulge, oh, I also have this egress point in the time of siege. So, with all of those people around the table, all of those minds, all of those different perspectives, he would have had a much better idea of how secure his castle actually was. You would never know this with black box work. And as it relates to this, just because, you know, when you're doing an assessment, just because you found something, just because you found something, does not mean that you found everything. And just because you found nothing, does not mean that something doesn't exist. So the only way you have a hard time finding everything is with the right perspective, the right mindset, the right methodologies. So going back, obviously, I can't mention a name, but through a series of discussions, we decided to split the work. And it's a really Fortune 100 company. It's a great gig for us. We want the work. But we also want to do this test of what it looks like side by side. What it looks like to do half the work from a black box perspective and half the work from a white box perspective. So they agreed, after many months of back and forth, to split the work. And so we had an equal distribution of resources. We had a team internally, kind of our best hackers, take on the black box portion. And then we had more of our computer scientists and cryptographers and those types of guys take on the white box side. And what we found was really, really interesting, and it provided an unbelievable amount of value to the company. And so what we found, again, equal distribution of resources. We worked on the black box 2 months, 200 hours, and we found 4 potential issues. And 2 of those issues were issues that the company already knew about. But due to the nature of the assessment, the black box, it didn't help us. So we wasted time. Another issue that we found was a mistake on our part. We did not fully understand how the system worked. So once we presented it to them, we discovered, okay, it is a function problem. That is what it is. This is not indeed a vulnerability. And the last issue was a confirmed vulnerability. It was a high level, it wasn't critical. And on the other side, the white box, again, equal distribution of resources, same number of guys, 2 months, 200 hours. What we found was in the first 2 weeks, we found 7 critical vulnerabilities. And this is something that's about to be released to all of you guys. And we found 7, in the first 2 weeks, we found 7 critical vulnerabilities. So we called the company and we said, hey, here's what we found so far. How do you want to continue this? And so what happened was, we ended up taking our team and embedding with their headquarters and working alongside the developers, their engineers, reviewing source code, having better access to design documentation, everything we could possibly want. And at the very end, we found not only 21 confirmed vulnerabilities, with I think 11 or 12 being critical, we also were able to provide 21 mitigation strategies for every single issue that we found. As opposed to the black box side, there are no mitigations provided to the account. That's up to them to fix. We don't have enough knowledge in order to provide the test mitigation strategy. So, over here, they spent 200 hours to find a problem. Over here, they spent 200 hours to find 21 problems and also 21 plus mitigation strategies. Extremely valuable to the client. Routers. You know, and I'm trying to move through this fast. Usually it's about an hour and 5 minutes. I'm trying to make this 40 to 45 minutes. So bear with me.
And one thing is not also working.
Routers. So this actually was, this work, this all of these breaks came from our research division. And one of our guys came to us and said, hey, I've been fiddling around with small office home office routers, and I'd like to turn this into a research project. I think there's a lot of valuable information here. I think we can do a lot of good with it. I think there's a big story to tell. We said, okay, that sounds good. We allow our employees probably 20% of their time to pursue research projects that they're passionate about. We're big on security. So as long as what we get out of it harmonizes with either the mission of the company, the education of the employee, or benefits our clients, we'll usually greenlight these projects internally. So what we have is, he came to us, and we gave him the go-ahead, and told him to go out and buy, let's say, 10 of the most popular small office home office routers. These are used in companies all across America, and homes all across America. They're used in hospitals to transfer data that should not be running across these networks. They're used everywhere. And so what we found after a few months, was that after initially greenlining 10, we actually bumped that up to 13, and we broke every single one. Initially, we thought, if we break three or four of these, that's something to talk about. We can produce a white paper on it. We can educate some people. But we broke every single one, and they were all susceptible to either remote attack, remote attack, or both. And what's interesting is this, you know, you think, okay, well, we all know routers are vulnerable, right? I mean, router hacking, we all know that they're vulnerable. But the depth of the study actually led to the Electronic Frontier Foundation getting involved in it. And it actually led to the first IoT village at DEF CON this past year. So a lot of good stuff came out of this. A lot of recognition for how crappy of a job most of these companies do shutting these routers out the door. As we look at it, it's really about functionality and it's not about security. And it's not really their fault. I mean, these are for-profit companies. This is what they do. So, real quick, maybe this thing will work. Yeah, there we go. So, this guy is a bad guy, and this is obviously a home office somewhere in California. Most likely San Diego, because I can assure you that the beaches in Austin, I mean, in Texas, look nothing like this. So, it's all seaweed and shells and things like that. Oh, here we go. So this is a bad guy. Let's just say he's a Romanian. That sounds good. And so in order for him to perform a remote attack, he has to have some involvement by this guy. Whether he navigates to an insecure page, whether he's a victim of a spear phishing campaign, whether he clicks on an ad on Yahoo, if it's obviously malicious ad in Yahoo, which I'm sure you guys remember over the last couple of years, that's been done many times. Not so much anymore, but at one time it was a big problem. And so once he gets that guy to navigate to a certain page, he can download malware, run some scripts, and then he has that now. And as far as that works.
Perfect. I'm gonna leave this here.
And so a local attack, well, not as sexy, is actually quite a bit scary because it involves no involvement on your part. I'm sure everybody here has gone to a Starbucks at some point in time, or some coffee shop, and connected to the network. This is actually really, really simple. And what happens is, and it does require their physical presence. So this part is true. But a bad guy can walk into a coffee shop, and he can connect to the Wi-Fi network. And with some simple tools, he can figure out exactly which router is powering that network with that Wi-Fi connection. And once he discovers that, he goes online, and he looks for known exploits for that particular router. And these are exploits that are reported by companies such as ours. Although we do go through the process of responsible disclosure, and we do provide mitigation strategies, as most research firms do, from the manufacturers who give them a certain amount of time to fix it. Here it is, here's what you need to fix, here's how you need to fix it, you hand it to them on a silver platter. A lot of them don't. But, you know, we eventually go to press and we talk about all of this stuff. So that guy can go online, figure out exactly what type of exploit he needs. He can download one of the automated scripts and then install the traffic across that exploit. And then he can force you to go to pages that you don't want to go to. And you then get all of your credentials for any of the sites that you go to, such as online banking or social media, whatever it is. Once they do that, they own everything.
And it's very, very simple.
And the message here, the key takeaway, is this idea of security versus functionality. So many times today, companies, again, these are for-profit companies and it's all about the money, are quick to let functionality rule the show, right? The more functions my particular router has,
probably the more routers I'm going to sell, and the more money that we're going to make. And a lot of times these things are shut out the door far too fast. And so functionality
basically rules over security. And not every router company is like that. There's actually some really good ones. ASUS does a great job with this. They always respond to us on time. They always, you know, want to talk to us about issues that we found and, you know, how can they fix them. They're great.
Who was that? ASUS. And if you walk into most of our analyst homes, you're probably not ASUS.
The problem with that is they also ask you to do firmware updates every week.
Now, there's some of that. But when you take a bunch of analysts and they're all buying the same router, it's because they can do things that most people can't. But from a foundational perspective, they're pretty good. And they're really good at fixing things. So, you know, yeah, everybody has their faults and their quirks, but they actually respond more to fixing. So we like that. And so one of the problems with it is this embarrassingly oversimplified corporate structure, where security and functionality battle it out, and they report to IT, who then reports to the C-suite guys. Right? Well, the C-suite guys, they want product out the door. In the router world, it's not necessarily the most secure thing. It's how many can we get out the door with the most amount of features, et cetera, et cetera.
And what a lot of security firms advocate is,
you have to break that up. Conflict is good. We want conflict, right? Because the priorities of these teams are extremely, they're just polar opposite. So we want IT security flowing up through security, who then reports to C-suite, and functionality reporting to IT,
who then reports to C-suite. And like I said, conflict is good. That's what we're going after.
And this is best illustrated by a story regarding a company that has no CMO. And let's just say that the CMO, Chief Marketing Officer, wants to go to a trade show. And he decides that this trade show is going to have all of his customers there, and he's the potential customers, and he's going to spend $100,000. Well, without a CMO, who's going to tell him no? How do we know that that's the best spend of a company's dollars? So if a CFO is on the scene, he's going to say, wait, let's talk about this. So we facilitate a dialogue, which is in the best interest of the company. And the shareholders. So perhaps that $100,000 is a good spend. Perhaps that's what we need to spend. Maybe we even need to spend more. Perhaps it's less. But at least there's a dialogue occurring about what the best thing to do with the company's dollars. And so, conflict is good. And we go back to priorities. The priorities are functionality and security are completely different. We have delivery deadlines and performance, which all relate to functional priorities. On the security side, we have access control, defense in depth, things like that. When they're between the same teams, we have the same people do that. It's responsible for security and functionality. Almost every single time, functionality wins today. Because that conflict actually undermines the objective when it's within the same team. But it's beneficial when it's between the teams. Facilitate dialogue. We discover ways to actually make something better, more secure, more functional, before it ever goes out the door to you guys.
Snapchat. Anybody remember this? So, that's when they were hacked. I kind of like that picture.
So Snapchat got hacked. And I'm actually going to spend very, very little time on the hack itself because it's probably the most boring hack, but it really illustrates a very, very important point.
So what happened was
Snapchat decided to roll out this feature called Add a Friend. And there's this thing called rate limiting that comes into play here. But basically what happened is
Without a friend, you could get Snapchat access to your phone, permission to access your contacts. It looks at those contacts, and then it spits back all of the ones that have in the database that have Snapchat. And at that point in time, you can say, well, I have that friend. I did not know they had Snapchat. Well, what a bad guy does, because Ray Lindenton doesn't exist, is he just uploads the whole phone book for San Diego or LA or whatever it is, and he sends it off to Snapchat. And Snapchat reports that, hey, here are all of your friends that have Snapchat. Who doesn't know anybody? He just opened a Snapchat account 30 minutes ago. So at this point in time, he's got all of these Snapchat users. Now, he's got the name, he's got the phone numbers, and he could just be annoying and call him. Calls and things like that. But he could also, as you guys know, probably use the same ID for different websites, right? Or, you know, whatever it is, banking or social media, or whatever it is. So what he could then do with that data is start leveraging that data to attacks on other sites, whether that's social media or banking or whatever it is. So it gives him ammo. And it was a bad deal. Snapchat just threw it out and said, let's just see what happens. And so the lesson in this is to build it in, not bolt it on. And Snapchat really didn't build it. They didn't build it in. They really didn't bolt it on. They just released it into the wild. And that particular attack could also could be leveraged in other ways on the phone and get access to other parts of your phone that most people haven't really spoken about. So it's really more serious than I make it out to be. But build it in versus bolt it on. And what we see is this idea of whenever you have a bug or a security issue or something like that in the requirements or the design phase or implementation, those things are incredibly easy and cheap to fix at that stage. If you try to fix a design bug in deployment, it's incredibly expensive and sometimes impossible. If you have to fix a security bug that arose out of, you know, some bad source code and you're trying to fix that in deployment, it's incredibly expensive and sometimes impossible. And so when we talk to clients, when really any good security firm talks to clients, we hear a lot of times, well, I don't have time to do that. I don't have the bandwidth to do that. Right? We're trying to build a project, bootstrap against whatever the excuses are. We've got timelines, we've got deadlines, we have to have this out by next quarter, whatever the reason is. Our response is always, you have the right people together right now. All you need to do is ask a few more questions. It's just a few more steps. It's not like we're asking you to reinvent the wheel. We're just saying, hey, just take this one step further. For example, in requirements, we are determining the needs of the business. Why are we building this? How are we going to build it? How do our customers benefit? Start talking about a threat model. When you're in implementation, when you're developing code, you know, from a security perspective, how do you code on it? Really simple. It's not that complicated. In testing, that's when, you know, you would want a vulnerability assessment performed. In deployment, you have configuration guidance. In maintenance, you have iteration planning. So there's a way to do it appropriately. And if you build it in, start with security as a foundation of what you're trying to, as part of the foundation for what you're trying to accomplish in the beginning, it's going to be far more effective and far less costly to do it that way. And so when we were coming up with this, we said, well, why don't we investigate our past work and see what those numbers actually are? I mean, we're asking companies to make a financial commitment up front that they may not have originally thought about. And so what does that mean from a financial perspective for the company? So what we found was that if you engage a security firm, and this wasn't just us, if you engage a security firm in the very beginning, in the requirement stage, it's about 10% cheaper than just having someone come in at the end of the build when you're ready to deploy and do a security assessment. So it's already cheaper. The real value comes in when, what does it cost to mitigate the issue? And what we found was, at the end of it, when you want us to bolt on a solution to the problem that you've created, it's 25 times more expensive to do that for an application, and 300 times more expensive to do that for an infrastructure environment. So what would have cost us $4,000 to fix in the beginning now costs us, I don't know, what, $300,000 for the application. So it's incredibly more expensive to fix it. And it's not nearly as effective. Last thing is the iPhone. I talked a little bit, I think, about the iPhone at the beginning. I'm trying to probably not want to do my time in class. So, the iPhone. What, you know, when the iPhone first came out, of course it changed everything, right? We had the power of the world at our fingertips. You kind of had that with the Trio and some Blackberries, but the iPhone really changed everything. Browsing the internet was a wonderful experience with the iPhone. And industries, whole industries have been built around this particular device. So when it came out, we wanted to be the first company to bring it, right? Just because it's a feather in our cap. We thought it would be cool if we were the first ones. So we started doing some research in the mobile browser functionality Apple desktops. And what we found is a few weeks before they released the iPhone, there was a vulnerability that was discovered in the Safari browser. And so we thought, for sure there's going to be a version of that browser ported over to the mobile device. And sure enough, there was. And so what we were able to do at this point in time was write a buffer overflow attack that enabled us to take control of the phone. And at the time, we had a New York Times columnist embedded in this project. And we were able to, from our offices in Baltimore, take control of his phone, get administrative access to his phone in New York. And we were able to send text messages, send and receive email, manipulate pictures, operate his camera, change all of his contacts from our office with his phone in New York. So the lesson, and you know, how do we keep things from happening like that? And Apple's, I think Apple's pretty good listening to security firms when they find issues. But this idea of security is an ongoing process. Again, it's a mindset, it's a perspective, right? The mindset has to change in order to deal with how modern attacks happen. And when you have security as an ongoing process, you know, what we see here, this chart right here, really illustrates feature creep. And I'm going a lot faster than I usually go to try to finish this up. This is feature creep. And as we know, all products, all systems iterate over time. And typically those iterations create new attack vectors. It's not a one-to-one ratio, but typically new attack vectors are released when products are iterated. And so, what typically happens in the security world is these long period review cycles where a company comes in once a year and performs this assessment, right? We've seen the cost, it's actually cheaper to do it more often, but this is what a long period review cycle looks like, where this is when it's secure, when you have an assessment, and of course, these are when you add new features and it becomes insecure. And what companies are more and more proposing are quarterly review cycles, where you don't have a company come in once a year, you actually engage that company throughout the year, and they do quarterly assessments. Now you might ask yourself, well, hell, if I can't pay for four, for one, how am I going to pay for four? And the answer is it's actually cheaper to have a security firm engaged throughout the entire project, throughout the entire year, than it is to have them come in once a year and perform an assessment. And the reason for that is, just like you guys, if you got on a project and then told to come back a year later and be at the same proficiency level, it takes time for you to do that, right? You have to get re-acclimated to the project, to the code that you're using, to what the what the purpose, what the original purpose of the build was, all of that kind of stuff. So what we find is that when you allow a security firm to work with you over the whole course of the year, it actually gets less expensive over time. And not only that, but you're able to call your security firm or your security team or whoever it is and actually have a conversation. When you're about to release a new product, when you're about to release a new feature on a particular system, that you can actually have a conversation with your security team and say, hey, what are the ramifications of this? What happens if I do this? And most of the time, the security team will be able to answer that question on the phone. Maybe they have to hang up and think about it for a little while. But you'll get an answer and you can proceed. And you'll have a much more secure product with that feature. So going back to the cost and why is this cheaper? Well, when a security firm is engaged over time, it takes a lot less effort on their part to basically do those assessments. Team is already up to speed. You already have access to all the source code, the design documentation. We just looked at it 45 days ago. So it becomes cheaper over time. In fact, these quarterly assessments are 20 to 30%, typically closer to 20, of what an annual assessment would be. So you get four for the price of one. And you also get a much more secure deployment, not particular product or system, whatever it is. That's it. So hopelessly broken was the router competition. You guys can look that up. That led to an engagement with the EFF and also the First IoT Village at DEF CON. Amin Secure is what I'm actually working on. That's an 18-month pilot program where we're trying to figure out how to discover, how to defend possible businesses. They're locally insecure. I know it's really tackled it from the angle that we're tackling it. We've got a lot of neat people on our advisory board, Dr. Larry Ponymon. Guys, there's a David Watson who's both the largest HIV in Texas. There's David Finn, who's the godfather of Symantec. We call him the godfather. And he's VP of Healthcare for North America. So we're getting ready to release that study probably in the next 60 days. I mean, it's not only going to be a study of the state of technology and healthcare, where we have some hospitals that have been in the program, as well as some technology companies. There's actually going to be a blueprint where they're giving away for free, we're not charging anyone for it, we need to demonstrate for this to use, so that these hospitals can actually become more secure. It's going to be a really piece of work for something that, as far as research goes, you do a lot of research and you do a lot. That's it. I tried to wrap it up in 50 minutes. There's probably 14 more slides that I've been going through, but I'm still 50 minutes. Any questions?
I'll throw one comment in.
Sure.
If you're doing an agile process on, say, a 2-week or 4-week cadence, at the point where you're starting up each sprint and you've done your user stories, that's the perfect time to get your security consultants or security team involved, because you've got written documents describing the sprint, they can provide feedback right at the beginning, and that can be very efficient.
Thank you. Any other comments? No other questions? Come over to Austin.
Thanks for listening. If you have questions about the material presented in this podcast, be sure and join our developers mailing list by sending an email to developers-subscribe@snea.org. Here you can ask questions and discuss this topic further with your peers in the developer community. For additional information about the Storage Developer Conference, visit storagedeveloper.org.